I'm Jeffrey Church from the Department of Political Science at the University of Houston. This is the Political Theory Review, a podcast of conversations with authors of recent books in political theory and social and political philosophy. Today, I'm talking to Frederick Neuhauser, professor of philosophy at Barnard College, Columbia University. We're discussing his recent book, Diagnosing Social Pathology, Rousseau, Hegel, Marx, and Durkheim, from Cambridge University Press. Neuhauser's research is on 19th century German philosophy and social and political philosophy, and has written extensively on Rousseau, Fichte, and Hegel. First of all, Fred Neuhauser, welcome to the Political Theory Review.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting me.
Fred, I love this book. I love the analysis of the state as a kind of organic body and how it can become ill or become healthy, at least according to a number of thinkers that you look at, from Marx to Hegel, including Durkheim, Rousseau, a number of figures. It's really helpful analysis, and I applaud you for the book. Let me ask you, first of all, what motivated you to write the book in the first place? Why this book on this topic?
Wow, that's a really hard question, actually.
I start with the hard one, sorry.
Let's see. So I started work on it quite a while ago, probably 12 years ago. And I guess I was, I got interested in the topic of social pathology from some people in the Frankfurt School, including Axel Honneth, and hadn't really thought much about that idea before. And then I also sort of independently, although it's pretty much related, I suppose, started teaching Durkheim in my classes. I didn't know much about Durkheim, but I started teaching. And I also got really interested in that. And then it seemed to me, once I did Durkheim's, you know, got more into his social philosophy and his account of social pathology, since he's probably the classical theorist of social pathology, I started thinking about ways in which the people I have been most interested in my career fit into that tradition or don't fit into it. So Rousseau, Hegel, and Marx, above all. I initially thought I might want to do chapters on, for example, Nietzsche and Kierkegaard, since pathology plays a really big role for them, and decided that it was too much, that these were not really theories of social pathology, but something else, maybe cultural pathology. And so I left them out. Maybe that's a good idea for a new project after this one's done.
Yeah, that's great. I wanted to start out just by, maybe you could say a little bit about what you don't mean by social pathology. This is kind of how you start the book in a way. You say in the preface that you kind of shot the book around early, as we often tend to do, and there's some resistance to conceiving of society as a kind of organism that can be healthy and ill. And it turns out, I mean, this is a kind of long tradition in philosophy and political theory to conceive, I guess, the body politic and the way that it can be healthy and ill. But there's kind of a variety of ways that one could think about that. Maybe you could just start by, you know, saying a little bit about what you don't mean, and then we can turn to what you do mean.
I suppose one thing that I don't mean, or one thing that I don't want to bring into my account of social pathology, is too much reliance on the society as organism metaphor. So there are very important ways in which I think societies are like organisms, but some theories of social pathology, especially ones that people want to reject for good reason, draw just too heavily on that analogy and sort of try to translate every feature of a biological organism onto society. So that's one. There are lots of conceptions of social pathology I want to reject. So one is, you know, these really pernicious conceptions of social pathology, which you find all over in fascist theorizing. And it's not just the Germans, it's also the Italians and the Spanish and so on, where groups of people tend to get identified in terms of, you know, they're like viruses or they're like some kind of foreign bearer of illness. And the implication is something like those groups of individuals need to be eradicated and then the body, the social body will be whole again. That's obviously a conception I don't want to. I've also not focused on, there are some conceptions of social pathology that use mental illness and try to understand, say, a society as having a kind of a psychosis or neurosis, where the model for that are is individual psychosis and neurosis. I'm not saying that's never appropriate, but that's just one of the things I'm not that I'm rejecting, that I'm not using. I guess maybe one more thing is to say I don't want the idea of social pathology to be I don't want the conception of social pathology to depend too much, or even to depend at all, on the idea that this society makes individuals within it physically or mentally ill. So that's a perfectly fine topic to talk about. And maybe that fits into the idea of social pathology to some extent, but it's not the main form social pathology takes for me. The sickness is supposed to be something, it's supposed to be a kind of dysfunctionality inherent in the social institutions, the social practices, and doesn't necessarily translate into individual members being ill.
Right. Yeah. Maybe say a little bit more about the kind of body politic or organic metaphor and what you find objectionable to it. I mean, I guess the first thing that comes to my mind when I think about, you know, social or political ills is to think of the political society as an organism, as many thinkers in the past did. This was a kind of standard fare for medieval political thinking, for example, right? You think of the political society as an organism, and like the head is like the people who are in charge, and the body, you know, the muscles are like the soldiers and so forth. Mm-hmm. This becomes standard fare, I think, up even through the modern period, and becomes a kind of conservative way of thinking about political society. I mean, even think, you know, like an easy example is like David Brooks in the New York Times often appeals to Burke, who's a, you know, figure who talks in organic terms about political society. And part of what they mean is that, you know, like it's an organism, so you can't make too radical of changes, because if you make radical changes, then the body sort of reacts and there are kind of unintended consequences for any kind of radical activity. So I take it that's what you don't mean by that, you know, kind of approach. Can you maybe say a little bit more about what you find, you know, problematic about that view?
So I suppose what you're pointing to are ways in which the idea of social pathology is used that make it a very conservative way of thinking about social ills. And you're right to say that I definitely don't want that to be the case. I think there's something about this view, as it's, so inspired by Hegel, I think there's something about the view that doesn't fit very well with the idea of radical revolution, and that certain kinds of reforms are more in line with this way of thinking about societies. On the other hand, I do include Marx, and I want to, I guess, leave open the possibility that certain forms of social dysfunction are so severe that the only way to get to a healthy state is to really radically transform institutions. I don't want exactly to rule that out. I understand. I definitely get the point you're making about Burke. I think that, and he's not all that far from Hegel in certain respects. You could definitely read this into Hegel's view. And I think probably Hegel is one of the theorists of social pathology who is more on the reform side of things than on the radical change side of things. I think one of the main sources of conservatism in this way of thinking about the social organism comes from taking over certain ideas about what health is that may or may not be true in the physiological realm. But one thing, for example, is the idea that the way to respond to pathologies in the social body are something like an absence of equilibrium, that there's a tendency to homeostasis in organisms, and that pathologies happen when this tendency towards homeostasis gets disturbed. And then there's definitely a kind of conservative view there, because it's like what you need to do is to restore that organism to this balance, to the state of balance. And that's just another way in which that's just part of something that I think none of these thinkers that I'm looking at want to think about social pathology as having that kind of implication.
Okay. So you maybe want to say a little bit about kind of, you started by talking about what you don't mean. Maybe you could say a little bit about what you do mean, how you do kind of conceive of social pathology in general, what kind of unifies these thinkers in terms of how they think about social health and illness.
Yeah. So maybe the place to start is the most general thing to say is maybe that the people whom I take most seriously all think of, when they think about what society is, they all think about it in terms of the category of life, social life. This is a really important theme, especially in the 19th century, but you certainly find it in Durkheim too. The question would be then, okay, so what is life such that we can think of societies in that terms, and that framework gives us a way of thinking about social pathology. So I would say one thing to say is that reproduction is one of the central functions of societies. Obviously, it's not the only one, and it's not only material reproduction. There's also what I call spiritual reproduction, the reproduction of individuals and their values and so on and so forth. But reproduction is a central thing of what societies are about. I think that's part of my view, and some people might find that problematic, but it seems to me like a plausible view. And then the idea, so I guess the idea then would be that what makes societies enough like organisms that it makes sense to talk about social pathology is that reproduction of social life is a very complex task that really can only be achieved through certain forms of differentiation within the society. So you might say semi-autonomous spheres or semi-autonomous, Durkheim calls them organs, but I would, I guess, not use that word just to not be so biological. Semi-autonomous subsystems or institutions or processes that are specialized and have to in some ways work together to achieve something, some aim of the whole, which would be reproduction. And reproduction, as I said, not just materially, but spiritually. And also what's really important in the case of societies, I guess, is that reproduction is never merely reproduction reproducing society as exactly the same thing it was before. Because we as human individuals are also reflective beings and we're the ones doing the reproducting, there's always a space for us to have a kind of distance to what we're doing. And that introduces the element of change and is actually even part of the idea of what a healthy socialism organism is like. It's also got the room for there being certain forms of spontaneity, certain forms of, doing things different, better, I guess.
Right. And the dysfunction comes in through a kind of conflict among the parts, or something like that, that parts start to come into some, you know, misalignment, or there's some, you know, one of the organs or institutional features kind of has an internal problem. Is there a way to kind of sketch in general about, you know, sort of how that kind of pathology comes to be in the developmental process? Is it some kind of tension between the spiritual or reflective parts of human beings and our natural or biological parts, or is it something else?
So I think there's no really good answer to that that covers all the bases. And I try to make my conception sort of open enough to include a lot of things. So the thing you mentioned is clearly one important version of social pathology, where for whatever reason, I don't really have a view of what these reasons might be. There are many kinds of it. The subsystems might come into conflict with one another, or one oversteps its proper boundaries. You find this in all kinds of social critique, in Habermas and Hegel, for example. But I don't think all or most social pathologies have to take this specific form. So if you think about Durkheim's definitely got this dynamic understanding of how societies develop and how they change. And for him, I think it's this change itself that introduces dysfunctions into the social body. So in other words, he'll often talk about certain aspects of society needing to catch up with others. An example would be like, I don't know, social structure may have changed in such a way that the old laws are no longer appropriate to the new social structure. And he's going to count that as a kind of social pathology, and talk about the need to bring our laws more into line with the underlying social structures that have developed. Another really important example would be ways in which, so I'm thinking here of, again, of Durkheim and of anomie, and the idea that individuals aren't, you might say, using his terms, you might say that individuals aren't sufficiently integrated into social life, where that not being integrated involves primarily the spiritual dimension of their relation to society, by which I mean only their own consciousness, their own values, their not feeling the obligations of social life puts upon them as meaningful, or, you know, something that they want to do. So that's another way pathology can enter. That's another way pathology can manifest itself. Then, sorry, I'll just name one more. So I think in Marx, to the extent that there's a conception of social pathology there, one of the major forms that's easiest to see is just this idea of recurring crises, where internal to the economy itself, portions of that economy are out of sync with one another. And that's more in a sense than of not an institution coming to conflict with other institutions, but an institution, as it were, coming into conflict with itself. The contradictions there, the conflicts, are internal to the capitalist economic system.
Yeah, that's good. So I wanted to turn to Marx. He's the first figure that you talk about to sort of work through the figures that you discuss. Maybe you could discuss a little bit about how Marx uses biological language in that analysis that you just made. I mean, it was a little bit surprising to me, actually, I hadn't recalled that he does use biological language, but I suppose it makes sense given his philosophical materialism, I suppose. But yeah, maybe it's sort of how he draws on this biological language in his analysis of the sort of dysfunctions of capitalism.
Yeah, so I'm not surprised to hear you say that, because I think I was surprised to find that myself when I went back to the text in writing this book. I should maybe say that I think, and others have pointed this out too, that Marx is probably the figure that fits least well into this book. And I've had to like find within him resources for thinking about social pathology, because he himself doesn't think very much in terms of pathology. He has at the beginning of Capital, in the introductions, he makes a lot of use of biological metaphors. And they have different, they're different biological metaphors. They're not always the same. One thing he means when he uses those biological metaphors in the preface there is the idea that a commodity producing society is, so a commodity producing society is going to rely on a lot of specialization and a lot of cooperation of these specialized processes within society. And they're also processes that are, as it were, bottom up in commodities, a commodity producing society, rather than from the top down. So there he's thinking about when he calls society in that, in these contexts, an organism, he's thinking about this, the ways in which the various individual economic processes are really, although they seem to be independent of one another, they really depend on an extreme form of organization that no brain or spinal cord ever imposed upon it, but that comes up, arises as it were, spontaneously. Durkheim uses this idea when he's talking about social organisms too, because he thinks, unlike his predecessor Comte, he thinks that the idea of a directing organ like the brain or the central nervous system really isn't very helpful in thinking about societies. He puts a lot of emphasis on the way societies get organized from the bottom up, as it were. Then there's this, also this really obvious stuff in Capital, where Marx doesn't say it exactly, but he's using biological metaphors all over the place when he's talking about the form of circulation of capital, how capital works. And so he describes capital as throwing off, in the German, throwing off offspring. That's like a very biological metaphor. It's like, it's just producing the way, I don't know, rabbits produce their young. And that in the case of capitalism, this is involves a kind of, this is now actually a separate point, but here it's the same part of capital, and it's the same like biological talk throughout, where capital, the formula for the circulation of capital reveals that capital grows in this completely unregulated way, that it's just growth for the sake of growth, with no kinds of real external constraints on that growth. That the cancer metaphor is just so obvious there, even though he doesn't specifically use that term, that it seems to me not unreasonable to attribute some of these ideas to him.
Yeah, that's good. I think part of what surprises me about Marx's use of biological language in the context of capitalism is that, you know, he's a reader of Hegel, and in Hegel's Civil Society section, of course, I mean, Hegel tends to think of the civil society section as kind of like the least organic part of, I mean, he talks about, you know, it's like modeled on planetary motion and so forth, you know, so it's kind of mechanistic as opposed to organic. Yeah. Okay. So it's, you know, that Marx sort of brings in biological as opposed to mechanistic, a mechanistic understanding is surprising. I mean, yeah, wouldn't mechanism fit better with his analysis? Maybe not.
Yeah, I see your point. Well, the reason you're saying mechanisms seems to fit Hegel's Civil Society better is because it seems to be made up of atomic individuals, and there's no direction or coordination of their activities. So yeah, I see that. And I the point you make is interesting. I never thought about it. Nevertheless, for Hegel, of course, civil society itself has to take its place within a more organically organized whole of the state as a whole. And when I think about the state for Hegel, I don't know that Hegel says this explicitly, but it seems to me like an idea that you could attribute to him. He's thinking about civil society needing to be constrained in ways by the state that make it co-functional with the family, for example, or that make citizenship in the state and all the subjective formation that's necessary for political participation, that makes all that possible. So there's still, you're right to say that that's the part of the state, the society that's least organically conceived by Hegel, and yet it has to fit into a state that itself is organically organized.
Yeah, that's good. Sorry, this is my tendency to jump immediately to Hegel. I know I have a sympathetic ear here. Let me just ask before we move away from Marx. You have you sort of conclude your discussion of this by bringing out the spiritual elements in Marx, that is spiritual in the German sense, the geistig components, not spookiness, but sort of human consciousness and normativity. Maybe you could talk a little bit about how you think those spiritual elements are crucial to understanding Marx and social pathology.
Yeah. So I think, for example, that commodity fetishism, in the way it's normally understood anyway, as a kind of ideology, can count for Marx as something like a social pathology. And it's a social pathology where the deficiency is a spiritual one in my terms, and in Marx's terms too. That is, where participants in commodity producing societies don't have the right, their practices aren't transparent to them. And so that's going to count for him, as it would for Hegel too, as a kind of spiritual deficiency. I guess, the spiritual elements come in everywhere in Marx and in different ways. So when he's talking about alienation in the 1844 manuscripts, I think you have to emphasize this idea that he himself sets out, but maybe doesn't emphasize as much as we might want to, this idea that we're different from the other animals because we have an ability to step back and take an attitude towards what we do. That's a moment of spirituality for Marx. And there are all kinds of ways in which that relation to what we do gets distorted, hindered within capitalist society for him. And those are going to count for him as spiritual failings of the society in question. Maybe one more thought. Let's see, what was I going to say here? Oh yeah, one more place I think this comes up is when you read in Capital about the secret of the production of surplus value, when Marx tells you where it comes from, even though it's hidden from our view, he immediately goes on to discuss what I take to be certain forms of ideology. He refers to them as, I don't know what the order is exactly, property, equality, freedom, and Bentham. And there might be one more in there that I'm forgetting. But I take that to be Marx's way of saying that we need these forms of consciousness to make capitalism do what capitalism does, so that even capitalism is relying on certain spiritual relations we have to what we do. But in the case of capitalism, these are deficient, and deficient in a variety of ways, sometimes because, as I just mentioned, they're not, our practices aren't transparent to us. Well, maybe these are all can come down to transparency, I'm not sure. The way in which we're as labor is exploited, is also not transparent to us, but hidden from us, and so on and so forth. So I think that even in, you know, dysfunctioning society, Marx is committed to the idea that some kind of spiritual relationship to what we do, some kind of conscious relationship to what we do, is crucial to the system's functioning as it does.
Right. And those 1844 manuscripts on alienation, right? It's our Gattungswesen, like our species being, is not only not transparent to us, it's we become, our labor becomes in service to our animality, as yes. opposed to our distinctive humanity, right? I mean, and that's at least I understand, you know, that's the pathology there, that it's like a reversal of the order of being, at least in the human species being.
Yeah, I totally agree. And you're right. And that's slightly different from what I was just talking about. That's another really important way in which spirituality, as it were, comes into Marx's view. It's like, you know, our activity is done for the sake of survival rather than because it's free activity valued by us for its own sake. That's another, you're absolutely right to point that out. That's another spiritual defect of capitalist society for Marx.
So that your next two chapters, I think sort of set up your final chapters on Durkheim and Hegel. You talk about Plato and Rousseau. And if I understand the development right, it's, you know, sort of you're discussing Plato in order to sort of, you know, explain a kind of functionalist account of human society. And then in Rousseau, it's Rousseau's contribution is this sort of the artificiality of the organism, right. That it's a contractually entered into organism, which is like an interesting idea. So maybe just like, if you want to, you know, briefly say a little bit about the Plato side of things, and then we can move to Rousseau.
Yeah, I think the Plato side of things is really straightforward. And but I had fun writing that somehow. Maybe it's because I'm not an expert in Plato, and it was like going back to something that I hadn't thought so much about, but that was fun. But I think the Plato thing is actually interesting for a variety of ways, reasons. One is just the obvious thing, that it introduces the idea of functionality right from the beginning, that when you're thinking about societies, you think about functions and how those functions get accomplished or carried out. And that leads you very quickly into the insight that functions have to be specialized and coordinated. And as soon as you get that, you get the idea of unbalance among the subsystems, as it were. But Plato's actually also got another, the idea that the parts of the polis might get out of balance, of the right balance, is surely an important idea for him. And it hooks up well with the idea of the soul as having the same form as the polis. But in the part of the Republic that I spent the most time thinking about, when Plato is reproducing in thought, or producing in thought, the polis, I think it's interesting that what you get there is not a pathology that where the parts are out of balance, but you get something like, it's a little bit like the idea of cancerous, unrestrained growth, which he expresses in terms of the metaphor of fever, of the feverish polis. And there, so what's interesting to me about that is, first of all, as I already said, it's not a kind of, I think it's not a form of pathology that involves the parts of the polis being out of sync, but rather the whole polis, as it will, being taken over by feverish desires. And one of the things that's important to me about that story is that for Plato, finding a pathological state comes before knowing what a healthy state is. And so there's a kind of negativity that I think is a methodological negativity, if you will, that I think is important to a lot of the theorists I look at, where we don't start off with the full picture of what social health would look like, but we're able to recognize certain pathologies, certain things that are pathological. before we have that full picture. And then looking at that pathology and understanding what it is helps us develop our idea of what a healthier society would look like. That's maybe all I have to say about Plato.
Mm-hmm. 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 Yeah, it's like human beings are the feverish animal, and we can develop our own means to overcome our natural feverishness. I mean, this is one way to think about Rousseau, I think. At least, anytime human beings emerge from a state of animality, I mean, it's almost immediately a kind of feverishness, inflamed amor prope, and so forth. And, the task in Rousseau is often to find various forms of social order that will mm-hmm. sort of regulate and direct our amor prope in the right kind of way in order to regulate it, right? You've written a lot on this, so I don't know if you want to say anything about that. Yeah,
I don't have anything more to say about that than what you already just said. I think it's absolutely right. And if I understood you correctly, what you're suggesting is that if you focus on something like this second discourse as a text that comes before the social contract, there is again this kind of methodology of I called it negativity, but where you first get these things that are recognizable as pathologies without a full understanding of what social health is. And you're looking at those is what leads you to develop a more determinate conception of what social health would look like. That's absolutely right. And you're right to bring out the real tight connection there between Rousseau. He got the idea, I'm sure, from thinking about Plato, the real tight connection there between pathology and feverish desires, because that's exactly what all of Amour, inflamed Amour prop is about in Rousseau.
Yeah, good. So could you say a bit about this artificial organism point? I mean, that I think you focus on in the social contract almost seems like a contradiction in terms, like an artificial organism. But it is true that, you know, in Plato, the organism, the whole precedes the parts in a certain way. But Rousseau wants to at least have the parts in precede the whole and at least develop, you know, putting together social contract. Anyway, so what do you take to be the significance of the social contract and that artificiality of the organism, body politic?
So, yeah, in talking about the artificiality of societies in the context of Rousseau, I tried to de-emphasize the idea of a social contract in a narrow sense and focus on what I think is a somewhat broader notion that all social life, including pathological social life, is based on conventions, where conventions are something like involve us or many of us accepting the normative authority of the rules that govern our practices and our institutions. It's a kind of us giving our assent, though assent is maybe too strong here because it can have weaker forms as well. But it's something like us giving our assent to the rules, maybe in a sort of unexplicit way, a not explicit way, where we take some part in reproducing those institutions by regarding those rules as things that have a kind of normative authority over ourselves. And that hooks up really well with some contemporary versions of social ontology that locate the specific quality of social reality in precisely that normative consensus, you might say.
Right. If I'm understanding, I mean, conventions can change from time to time, and we're in fact the creators of these conventions. They're not, you know, biologically necessary, and so the conventional orders, even though they sometimes can masquerade as sort of natural, you know, like this is the way men and women like naturally are. Well, no, in fact, these are you know, sort of conventions that that we ourselves have created. So there's a kind of a human creative artificial character to all of them, and then an artificial way in which we stand towards those in assent or rejection. I mean, the case, I think you mentioned the men and women example in this chapter is a make explicit to ourselves our own constructed character of these norms. Right.
And the artificiality doesn't consist merely in the fact that at some point human beings invented these conventions, but also in the fact that we are ongoing reproducers of those conventions in our ordinary social activity. Now, sometimes we do stop doing that, or we question those conventions and don't take them to be normative authority. But basically, this I think the idea is that there wouldn't be social life at all without a thoroughgoing, a rather extensive, implicit consensus about the authority of the norms, of the rules that we live by in social life.
Good. Yeah, I don't mean to rush us to Durkheim, but as I understood your book, it's sort of a lot of this is sort of, you know, preparing the way for the two major figures at the end. You have, right. I think, yeah, four chapters on Durkheim and then four chapters on Hegel. So Durkheim is an interesting figure. You know, it's not usually read or discussed by philosophers. Maybe you could start by, you know, sort of sketching how you take, you know, Durkheim's sort of functionalist view of political society as sort of building on Plato and Rousseau, the account that you've sketched so far.
Yeah, right. So I think Durkheim brings out in an even more explicit way that social life is thoroughly dependent on rules that we accept and use to govern our own activity within society, our own social activity. So the idea of social life being rule governed, or it's not always rules. He talks about it as rules, but sometimes rules are really something a little bit broader than that, like norms and values as well. Durkheim's just a lot more explicit about the importance of that in social life than Rousseau is. So that's, there's also this added thing in Durkheim that is at least extremely interesting, where social reality has its source, or maybe social authority has its source in the experience of the religious. That's not something you get in Rousseau. And maybe it's not something we even want to retain from Durkheim, but it's really an interesting point. And I think I'm inclined to be more specific, more sympathetic to that than I might have been originally, because Durkheim uses it to explain why social norms have for us I hate to use this word, a quasi-sacred nature, or if you want to speak more of the language of Kant, how social rules are rules we take to realize something more than merely, I don't know, utility or pleasure, realize our satisfy our desires. We take it to give, we take our social institutions to give us, I think Durkheim would say, sort of, they give us a kind of transcendental meaning, give a kind of transcendental meaning to what we do in the social world that's not completely unrelated to Weber's idea of value rational activity as opposed to merely instrumental activity. So there's something about, maybe this is what I think Durkheim does a bit better than Rousseau. Although you could find this in Rousseau too, but it's much more explicit in Durkheim. There is something about social life that gives our lives a larger meaning, a deeper meaning beyond the merely useful or the merely pleasant. And that's important to me. I think that's there's something right about that insight.
Yeah, that's really useful. I mean, in part because it helps to me, maybe I'm jumping to conclusions here, but his one of his central social pathologies, you mentioned it earlier, that of anomie.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, a lot of figures in the 19th century sort of are keyed into something like this phenomenon, that of the, you know, in the decline of religion and other forms of integrating institutions into the modern world. It's sort of the fragmentation and disillusion of a political society that sort of shoves people into their own kind of little worlds. And so the task becomes for a lot of modern thinkers to think about what are kind of integrating institutions. And so Durkheim's sort of view of anomie as a kind of, that kind of wandering without a norm to guide us. So is the sacredness then the way to integrate, that Durkheim thinks is the central kind of integrating function that we should be
aiming for? Right, because that's how he's thinking of what the phenomenon of religion does, especially early forms of religion. It's integrating the society by means of a sense of the sacred. And there's some sense in which, even in a secular world for Durkheim, we need some analog to that in our social life in order to have healthy social lives. And if we don't, one of the dangerous consequences is anomie. And you're also really right to, I think, point out that this was something like the same phenomenon was a concern for many thinkers of the 19th century. You could say for Marx and Hegel too. Look, for Marx, it's not going to be, sacred, but there's something that gives meaning to our lives that enables us to find what we do meaningful and satisfying. And of course, the other obvious figure in this regard is Nietzsche. It's not so much a social solution for Nietzsche, but that's exactly the phenomenon Nietzsche's on about with the falling apart of Christianity, and that things cease to have meaning for us. That's in Weber too. Obviously, Weber got it from Nietzsche. But yeah, that's a really important part of the story. You're right.
Good. Yeah. As I understand, one of the other things you're doing with Durkheim, and maybe you could say a little bit more about it, because I'm interested in this thought, which is kind of, it's almost a methodological point about how he conceives of what Durkheim calls the science of morality. That's what he identifies sociology, or the role, task of sociology, which is kind of an amazing and sweeping point. I doubt my sociologist colleagues right down the hall.
Right.
If I went and asked them if they were interested in the science of morality, I'm not sure what they would say. But maybe you say a little bit about, how Durkheim develops this idea of the science of morality. I think you think it's you conceive of it kind of along the lines of Adam Smith, and the way that Smith and the Wealth of Nations sort of, I think, is very, it's almost like starting from an empirical,
yes,
social scientific viewpoint, and then sort of developing out philosophical conclusions. Could you develop that a little bit?
I think this is one of the hardest points in the book, and maybe I haven't articulated it in a completely satisfactory way, but you're right. I think of what Durkheim's doing is, so Durkheim thinks that understanding the way society works is also going to provide you with moral orientation, and that's why sociology is a science of morality. And it's really mystifying, or at least for us, it's really hard to sort of understand how that could be. Though, as I say in the book, I think it's true also for Hegel, and even for Adam Smith. Adam Smith has a sort of early version of this. And so it might be easier to talk about Adam Smith, but I'm thinking now about the Adam Smith of The Wealth of Nations, and I'm not really considering how that might fit together with the theory of moral sentiments, though it probably, it could, I think, but I don't really have a view on how it does exactly. you ask how both Durkheim and Smith ask, how does this society before me function? And I suppose asking how it functions is at first not an explicitly moral question. For Smith, it's a question about how the economy, how commercial society functions. And in the course of figuring out how commercial society functions, so in the case of capitalism or commercial societies for Smith, we need individuals who enter into the economic sphere with certain legal statuses, with certain conceptions of what they want, certain conceptions of themselves. And it's like, it's almost like the there are certain moral ideals that fit the way the economic system functions, or certain moral ideals have, this is also Nietzsche too, have an elective affinity with the way the social world is structured and the way it functions. And even though I don't think Durkheim has a fully adequate view of how this gets us all the way to, you know, normatively authoritative rules, there's a way in which they both think you can't think about which moral ideals are appropriate for us without thinking about how society is structured, about how its subsystems function, including that of the economy. So maybe just to give two examples, the idea of individuals being free for Smith is just so crucial to the way capitalist society is organized. You have free wage laborers who enter freely into contracts with their workers, and that, you know, in order for that to function, individuals have to think of themselves in a certain way and have to think of themselves, their freedom, as something that's valuable to them, and so on. And there's, as I said, there's a kind of elective affinity between these moral ideals and social functioning. And something similar is going on with Durkheim in a more, perhaps in a more articulated way. He's got a rather complicated story about how increasing complexity in societies makes brings about a certain kind of individualism, because you're no longer as immediately identified with the social whole as you might be in less complex societies. And so the values of individualism sort of fit well, individual liberty, autonomy, there's other things as well, individual development, the particularity of my individual element, and so on. These ideals fit well with a society where the social structure requires us to think of us as individuals. That's maybe a very rough sketch of what the basic idea is.
Yeah, is this, maybe I don't want to simplify it and distort it too much, but it's a thought I find interesting. I mean, is this another way to put it? I mean, there, you know, you can think of kind of the way that morality relates to politics in one of two ways. Like, one is, I just call it like a transcendent view that's associated with somebody like Plato or the Platonic tradition, where you develop certain norms that are independent of and that transcend any kind of particular political society, and you can apply them to any one society universally in history. And then by contrast, there's kind of like you might call an imminent view of moral political analysis that maybe you could associate with the Aristotelian tradition, whereby you think about how, you know, human moral systems themselves develop, and how morality as a social institution develops out of our interactions with one another and through our economics and art and so forth, and how all those institutions themselves have a life of their own, and how they come into conflict with one another and develop. And I mean, is that it's that imminent tradition that I take it that's something like Durkheim. Is that a fair summary?
Yes, I left out that word, that idea, when I was explaining it, but you're right. These are all involved a much more imminent approach to moral ideals than starting from some moral starting point that abstracts from the particular nature of. So I think that it's not just Plato who does this, at least the way I understand Plato, but even Rousseau, the norms are sort of somehow out there, almost like Platonic forms. They're not, they don't themselves follow out of some analysis he's got of social development. I think that's the case anyway.
Yeah, and this is, maybe this will make a bridge to Hegel. One of the things I think it was in your maybe one of your introduction chapters, you talk a little bit about the tradition of the philosophy of history in the 19th century, and a little bit about your skepticism about it. Maybe you could say a little bit more about that, because part of, at least how I understand one of the motivations for the tradition of the philosophy of history, say, for example, in Hegel, but also I'm teaching Mill right now, so, you know, Mill would be another figure on this, is precisely to kind of develop certain kinds, like a way to make intelligible that imminent development of the institutions and rules and laws. So in other words, if we want to develop a science of how to think about how morality interacts with these institutions, like we'll want to develop a philosophy of history whereby we kind of make that development intelligible. What do you think about that? I mean, to say a little bit about the philosophy of history. Yeah,
I think Hegel and Marx both have strong versions of that, where certainly in Hegel, but I think at least parts of Marx have this as well. Something like the idea that you need a philosophy of history in order to, I don't know, ground the normativity of what you want to say about social pathologies and so on. And I've tried to develop an account of social pathology that doesn't rely on a philosophy of history, at least of a certain kind. I think there are many different kinds of philosophy of history, but not in the kind that Hegel and Marx seem to be involved in. And so I actually think that Durkheim comes a little bit closer to doing this than Hegel and Marx. It's complicated because Durkheim also has a philosophy of history. He seems to think that there's a pattern of historical development that societies are more or less bound to go through, and that they will be similar developmental processes, though some societies get started on it earlier than others and so on. So he's definitely got some version of universal history there, but I don't think Durkheim relies so much on the story about universal history to give normative forces to give normative force to the ideals he's using when he's talking about a healthy society. So he often, in other words, maybe what I'm trying to say is, it seems to me like in Durkheim, there's a lot more room for social, for the contingency of development. It doesn't seem like anything. So when he's describing the change from old mechanically organized societies to organically organized societies, there's a kind of chance almost to the things that happen and make the old societies obsolete. And I want to also rely on, I also want to stake out a view where our subscribing to the moral ideas we do doesn't require us to posit some kind of universal history. I don't know whether I've succeeded in that. That's, as I said, one of the most difficult parts of the book. But here again, immanence and immanent method can come into play, because a lot of the critique is going to take place by showing how what we actually do in social life doesn't measure up to the ideals that we take to inform what we're doing. And so there's a source of criticism that doesn't, it seems to me, rely on like some telos, some understanding what the end is going to be.
That's great. Well, so that's a good transition to Hegel, the hero of your book, I think.
Yeah.
Or maybe protagonist, I'm not sure what the metaphor is. Anyway, could you, and you've written a lot about Hegel, could you say a little bit about how you think Hegel sort of figures into this tradition, how he builds on the tradition of social pathology? I mean, you bring in, it was helpful for me, you brought in this figure, Vincent Descombes, who has kind of you attribute kind of a similar view about Hegel, but, you know, feel free to sort of draw on him and, you know, just, you know, in sketching kind of generally what Hegel's distinctive contribution is here.
Yeah. Yeah. So basically your question is, Hegel is the hero of the book, but what exactly is Hegel's distinctive contribution? Maybe two things here. I just think there's a lot more detail in Hegel, in what Hegel says about social institutions in the Philosophy of Right, that illustrate the points I want to make about social pathology than there is even in Durkheim. There's more raw material there. So Hegel has great insights into the way the changing nature of civil society requires families and the norms that govern family life to change over time, to sort of get in sync with one another, as it were. So partly it's a matter of detail, but maybe the most important conceptual thing is, I think Hegel is the only one of the theorists who's done justice to the spiritual nature of social life. So obviously, as I said earlier, both Durkheim and Marx think of social life as spiritual life. But here's I guess what I want to say. I think there are the resources in Hegel, and that Hegel himself does this sometimes, for making the point that in the case of human societies, dysfunctions or pathologies are always at the same time moral failings as well as functional failings in a narrower sense of the term. And so I don't think Marx has got that same idea. And I don't think in the end Durkheim has that idea so much either. So, you know, again, the part of Hegel that I think you can see this in most clearly, although it's very abstract, is the master-slave dialectic. And I take that to be the description of a kind of pathological, dysfunctional society. It's also functional to a certain extent. Nothing is ever completely dysfunctional. It's also functional to some extent, but there are dysfunctions, dysfunctions that are recognizable as dysfunctions from within that form of life itself. But those functions are always both, I don't know, if you want to put it this way, material and moral failings. So it's not just that things don't work smoothly. It's that the moral ideals we rely on to engage in these processes are also not well realized by those processes. And I guess that's the one thing about Hegel that I want to take and emphasize most, the idea that, just to repeat, dysfunctions are always also moral failings as well as functional failings in a narrower sense.
Yeah, the master-slave dialectic is a useful illustration because I think it's pretty familiar to folks. One other feature I think of that analysis in Hegel would be, I guess you could say the, I don't know, he doesn't use this term, but like the self-correcting nature of the pathology, in the sense that part of Hegel's analysis, of course, is that you know, the master, the slave's distinctive kind of relationship puts him in a position of laboring on nature, which is a form of spiritual development, and the master languishes without that kind of form of spiritual development, which means that eventually, in other words, it eventuates into a system of free self-determination. Is that part of Hegel that you think useful as well, or how do you conceive of that part of Hegel? Yeah,
that very specific part I tend to distance myself from. So as I understood what you're saying something like an important part, and this is because it's in the Phenomenology of Spirit, of course, an important part of the master-slave for Hegel is the idea that the master-slave is not just dysfunctional. It also at the same time develops resources that can be used to get out of that and to institute a more spiritually satisfying form of life. And, you know, I think that's an idea Marx himself takes over from, he says, what's that famous line about a society never grows old without the resources for the new and better society to be developed within its womb? That seems to me in both Hegel and Marx to be overly optimistic. And so that's a part I don't want to necessarily take over, although I would want to be enough of a Hegelian to say something like, recognizing our social pathologies as such, recognizing them as both moral and sort of functional failings, it's not like we're guaranteed that we've now got the resources to get out of the problem, but grasping them as social pathologists in the right way at least gives us some guidance about what we need to do and what we're in a position to do to make things better. So maybe there's a little bit of a Hegelian element that gets snuck back in, but I think both Hegel and Marx have this overly optimistic view about, as I said, we'll always somehow have the resources to get out of this.
Yeah, right. I mean, it might be a fallback on a kind of Kantian justified hope. At least that's how I think of his philosophy of history anyway. I mean, that might not work out for whatever kind of system that you want to, but at least, you know, there are resources within the institution that maybe you could draw on in your own development that could give you a justified hope in improving things.
That's actually really interesting because I love that part of Kant and it doesn't come up in the book at all. I think both Hegel and Marx have something stronger than Kantian hope, but maybe what you're suggesting is that Kantian hope is a little bit more like what I want there to be than what Marx and Hegel have. And that's kind of a sympathetic thought to myself for precisely the reason that I sort of like this idea of Kant's. It's another way in which the practical has primacy over the theoretical. It's like being committed to the realization of freedom pushes us in one direction with regard to what we believe and what we do and how our practices are structured rather than in the other direction.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, I often talking to young people, for example, about capitalism, for example, you know, and there's often a like, you know, it's like irredeemably corrupt or like the, structure is like so thoroughly dysfunctional that there's really no hope. And Hegel is useful, I think, in this way and sort of, you know, you can point to certain kinds of features that are within capitalism that say, well, no, look, I mean, there's this thing that can be developed here. You know, there are forms of order that are genuine forms of freedom enhancing in capitalism. It's just that there are these other things that are a problem. So that we can have resources, in other words, to give young people hope. Isn't that what we do as educators so much?
Yeah. You know, and when you put it in this way, it makes me think that that's really the best way of, even if this is, may not be exactly how Marx himself thought of it, that may be the best way to think about what Marx is doing in Capital when he's thinking about how capitalism itself, without us intending to do it, develop certain resources that could be taken up and used to produce a better social world than we have. So leave out the idea that the revolution isn't somehow necessary, or that we can know that there are the resources there for a successful transformation. But to think about them as you just suggested, him thinking about what late capitalism looks like and where the resources might be for getting out of the problems capitalism is in. I think that's a helpful way of thinking about what Marx is doing. Otherwise, it looks too mechanistic and too optimistic and too, yeah.
Yeah, I agree. So maybe we could just finish up. I mean, you mentioned a couple that, you know, how Hegel helpfully brings out some kind of more detailed analysis of social pathologies. Maybe you could just talk about one or two. I mean, the philosophy of right, of course, probably the most famous one is the discussion of poverty, yeah, and the rabble as a kind of intrinsic, you know, maybe ineradicable feature of modern commercial society. Right. So, you know, maybe you could talk about that or any other kind of social pathology in Hegel's philosophy of right and how it kind of manifests some of the things you've been talking about.
Yeah, so I actually don't. So I think it's important to notice that there's very little discussion of social pathology in the philosophy of right, precisely because Hegel's project there, the official project anyway, is to reconcile us to a world he thinks is already in basic outline rational. And so in that sense, you're not going to get a lot of emphasis on pathologies, whereas in the phenomenology of spirit, the emphasis is really on a certain kind of development. And so development springs out of contradictions and what I'm calling pathologies and dysfunctions. And so that's in some ways a more suitable source for thinking about what social pathologies might look like for Hegel. And I suppose I could have done a lot more with the phenomenology of spirit, going back to the analysis of Antigone and so on, by looking at the phenomenology. So you're absolutely right that poverty seems to be poverty here is really, I think, for Hegel, civil society's inability to provide work and meaningful work too, but also just plain old work, wages, to its participants. And this is, I think you're right, this is clearly the most explicit example of a pathology. And it's also really interesting because Hegel doesn't seem to find a real solution to it. There's sort of different things he considers, but none of them really quite do the trick. And so I think I would say, don't really look to the philosophy of right so much for help with social pathologies. But what I was saying, this the philosophy of right is really helpful with, I was thinking of the things Hegel says. They seem to be things he says on the side, but I think they're important to what he's doing about how the modern family had to change from the traditional extended family in order to function well with the other institutions of modern society. So there are all kinds of aspects of civil society, modern civil society, that are unsuited to the traditional family, where you've got these substantial bonds to, the extended family that really impinge on the kind of individual freedom and individuality that civil society seems to require. And so I'm reading, I guess this is a similar point to what I was saying about Durkheim, though I think it's sort of more sketched out in Hegel. I'm thinking about ways in which the family has to adjust its norms and the way it functions in order to fit in well with civil society. So now we need a family that functions not by tying individuals to the, you know, the clan, as it were, but by that it's a nuclear family now. That's the form the family takes, and it doesn't involve you having these really substantial obligations to your uncles and your aunts and your grandparents, and not even to your parents once you reach a certain age. And we need a family that brings kids up, at least the boys in Hegel's case, to think of themselves as individuals, to think of themselves as having individual projects that then sort of pushes them out into civil society and makes their participation in civil society possible and meaningful for them.
Yeah, that's great. I we could go on, I'm sure, for hours about this. I'm going to bite my tongue, but let me just ask you one last kind of, you know, summary question. Sometimes I end in this way, which is something like the following. How do you think that conceiving of social of society in these terms of social pathology, in the terms of your book, how do you think it can kind of improve contemporary, either philosophical or political discussions? Is it something that can kind of enrich social criticism, you know, or something else? What do you take to be, you know, kind of the contribution of the book in terms right. of, you know, beyond the confines of scholarship?
So maybe what I would say here is that rather than focusing on the category of social pathology itself being absolutely crucial and so on, would be to focus instead on how the conception of social reality that underlies diagnoses of social pathology being the more important thing. So in other words, we need to keep in view that social reality is a form of social life in exactly the sense I sketched out much earlier in the interview. And so just one example of that would be, we can't keep on doing political philosophy in the analytical tradition in abstraction from social theory and how the social institutions function, as if those two things were completely separate. Rawls is one analytic political philosopher who starts moving in that direction, although it's in part three of the theory of justice, which everyone claims he rejected and had to reject. That's actually my favorite part of theory of justice. So the interdependence of politics with the other spheres of society would be one thing. I mean, the other thing is just that I think conceiving of social reality in this way as life, as something similar to organic life, and thinking in terms of pathologies, draws our attention more to the social dynamics and the social forces that are at play, rather than merely criticizing them normatively as unjust. It's important to understand the sort of durability and the stubbornness of those malfunctioning institutions by understanding, thinking about how these forces, these dynamics are implicated in the process of social reproduction, rather than just offering a purely normative critique that is removed from understanding how society works. Those are two very broad things, maybe.
Both excellent. I endorse both of them. So good. This has been a lot of fun, Fred. Thank you so much for joining me again on the Political Theory Review.
Thanks for inviting me, and thanks for taking so much care with my book, which isn't that easy to read, I think, in some places. But I really appreciate the chance and the time to talk to you about it. I hope we can do more soon.
Me too.
You've been listening to the Political Theory Review. Find us on the web and on iTunes. Thanks to the Starting Points Journal for partnering with us. And thanks to you for listening.